The reader must now forget Chestnuts and Coats and accompany us further west. The following days were marked by a number of great thunderstorms, or perhaps there was but one single thunderstorm which progressed across the country in ponderous frog leaps and which we could not shake off, just as we could not shake off Detective Trapp. For it was during those days that the problem of the Aztec red convertible presented itself to me, and quite overshadowed the theme of Lowe's lovers. Queer, I who was jealous of every male we met, queer how I misinterpreted the designations of doom. Perhaps I had been lulled by Lowe's modest behaviour in winter. And anyway, it would have been too foolish even for a lunatic to suppose another Humbert was avidly following Humbert and Humbert's nymphette with Jovian fireworks over the great and ugly plains. I surmised, donc, that the red yak keeping behind us at a discreet distance mile after mile was operated by a detective, whom some busybody had hired to see what exactly Humbert was doing with that minor stepdaughter of his. As happens with me at periods of electrical disturbance and crepitating lightnings, I had hallucinations. Maybe they were more than hallucinations. I do not know what she or he or both had put into my liquor, but one night I felt sure somebody was tapping on the door of our cabin, and I flung it open and noticed two things, that I was stark naked, and that white glistening in the rain-dripping darkness, there stood a man holding before his face the mask of jutting chin, a grotesque sleuth in the funnies. He emitted a muffled guffaw and scurried away, and I reeled back into the room and fell asleep again, and I'm not sure even to this day that the visit was not a drug-provoked dream. I have thoroughly studied Trapp's type of humour, and this might have been a plausible sample. Oh, crude and absolutely ruthless. Somebody, I imagine, was making money on those masks of popular monsters and morons. Did I see next morning two urchins rummaging in a garbage can and trying on jutting chin? I wonder. It might have all been a coincidence, due to atmospheric conditions, I suppose. Being a murderer with sensational but incomplete and unorthodox memory, I cannot tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the exact day when I first knew with utter certainty that the red convertible was following us. I do remember, however, the first time I saw its driver quite clearly. I was proceeding slowly one afternoon through torrents of rain, and kept seeing that red ghost swimming and shivering with lust in my mirror, when presently the deluge dwindled to a patter, and then was suspended altogether. With a swishing sound, a sunburst swept the highway, and needing a pair of new sunglasses, I pulled up at a filling station. What was happening was a sickness, a cancer that could not be helped, so I simply ignored the fact that our quiet pursuer, in his converted state, stopped a little behind us at a café or bar, bearing the idiotic sign, The Bustle, a Deceitful Seatful. Having seen to the needs of my car, I walked into the office to get those glasses and pay for the gas. As I was in the act of signing a traveller's cheque, and wondered about my exact whereabouts, I happened to glance through a side window and saw a terrible thing. A broad-backed man, baldish, in an oatmeal coat and dark brown trousers, was listening to Lowe, who was leaning out of the car and talking to him very rapidly, her hand with outspread fingers going up and down, as it did when she was very serious and emphatic. What struck me with sickening force was, how should I put it, the voluble familiarity of her way, as if they had known each other, oh, for weeks and weeks. I saw him scratch his cheek and nod and turn and walk back to his convertible, a broad and thickish man of my age, somewhat resembling Gustav Trapp, a cousin of my father's in Switzerland. Same smoothly tanned face, fuller than mine, with a small dark moustache and a rosebud degenerate mouth. Lolita was studying a road map when I got back into the car. "What did that man ask you, Lowe?"
"Man? Oh, that man. Oh, yes. Oh, I don't know. He wondered if I had a map. Lost his way, I guess."
We drove on, and I said, "Now listen, Lowe, I do not know whether you are lying or not. I do not know whether you are insane or not, and I do not care for the moment, but that person has been following us all day, and his car was at the motel yesterday, and I think he is a cop. You know perfectly well what would happen and where you will go if the police find out about things. Now I want to know exactly what he said to you and what you told him."
"If he's really a cop," she said shrilly but not illogically, "the worst thing we could do would be to show him we're scared. Ignore him, Dad."
"Did he ask where we were going?"
"Oh, he knows that," mocking me.
"Anyway," I said, giving up, "I've seen his face now. He's not pretty. He looks exactly like a relative of mine called Trapp."
"Perhaps he is Trapp. Oh, if I were you. Oh, look, all the nines are changing into the next thousand. When I was a little kid, she continued unexpectedly, I used to think they'd stop and go back to nines if only my mother agreed to put the car in reverse. It was the first time, I think, she spoke spontaneously of her pre-Humbertian childhood. Perhaps the theatre had taught her that trick. And silently we travelled on, unpursued. But the next day, like pain in a fatal disease that comes back as the drug and hope wear off, there it was again behind us, that glossy red beast. The traffic on the highway was light that day. Nobody passed anybody, and nobody attempted to get in between our humble blue car and its imperious red shadow, as if there were some spell cast on that interspace, a zone of evil mirth and magic, a zone whose very precision and stability had a glass-like virtue that was almost artistic. The driver behind me, with his stuffed shoulders and trappish moustache, looked like a display dummy, and his convertible seemed to move only because an invisible rope of silent silk connected it with our shabby vehicle. We were so many times weaker than his splendid, lacquered machine, so that I didn't even attempt to outspeed him. O lente carite noctis equi, O softly run nightmares. We climbed long grades and rolled downhill again, and heeded speed limits and spared slow children, and reproduced in sweeping terms the black wiggles of curves on their yellow shields. And no matter how and where we drove, the enchanted interspace slid on, intact, mathematical, mirage-like, the viatic counterpart of a magic carpet. And all the time I was aware of a private blaze on my right, her joyful eye, her flaming cheek. A traffic policeman, deep in the nightmare of crisscross streets, at 4:30 p.m. in a factory town, was the hand of chance that interrupted the spell. He beckoned me on, and then with the same hand cut off my shadow. A score of cars were launched in between us, and I sped on and deftly turned into a narrow lane. A sparrow alighted with a jumbo breadcrumb, was tackled by another, and lost the crumb. When, after a few grim stoppages and a bit of deliberate meandering, I returned to the highway, our shadow had disappeared. Lola snorted and said, "If he is what you think he is, how silly to give him the slip." "I have other notions by now," I said.
"You should check them up by keeping in touch with him, father dear," said Lo, writhing in the coils of her own sarcasm.
"Gee, you are mean," she added in her ordinary voice. We spent a grim night in a very foul cabin under a sonorous amplitude of rain, and with a kind of prehistorically loud thunder incessantly rolling above us.
"I am not a lady, and I do not like lightning," said Lo, whose dread of electric storms gave me some pathetic solace.
We had breakfast in the township of Soda, Pop 1001. Judging by the terminal figure, I remarked, "Fat Face is already here."
"Your humour," said Lo, "is side-splitting, dear father."
We were in sagebrush country by that time, and there was a day or two of lovely release. I had been a fool, all was well. That discomfort was merely a trapped flatus, and presently the mesas gave way to real mountains, and on time we drove into Wace. Oh, disaster! Some confusion had occurred. She had misread the date in the tour book, and the magic cave ceremonies were over. She took it bravely, I must admit. And when we discovered there was in Curortish Wace a summer theatre in full swing, we naturally drifted toward it one fair mid-June evening. I really could not tell you the plot of the play we saw, a trivial affair, no doubt, with self-conscious light effects and a mediocre leading lady. The only detail that pleased me was a garland of seven little Graces, more or less immobile, prettily painted, bare-limbed, seven bemused pubescent girls in coloured gauze that had been recruited locally, judging by the partisan flurry here and there among the audience, and were supposed to represent a living rainbow, which lingered throughout the last act and rather teasingly faded behind a series of multiplied veils. I remember thinking that this idea of children colours had been lifted by authors Claire Quilty and Vivian Darkbloom from a passage in James Joyce, and that two of the colours were quite exasperatingly lovely, Orange, who kept fidgeting all the time, and Emerald, who, when her eyes got used to the pitch-black pit where we were all heavily sat, suddenly smiled at her mother or her protector. As soon as the thing was over, and manual applause, a sound my nerves cannot stand, began to crash all around me, I started to pull and push low toward the exit, in my so natural amorous impatience to get her back to our neon-blue cottage in the stunned, starry night. I always say nature is stunned by the sight she sees. Dolly-Lo, however, lagged behind in a rosy daze, her pleased eyes narrowed, her sense of vision swamping the rest of her senses to such an extent that her limp hands hardly came together at all in the mechanical action of clapping they still went through. I had seen that kind of thing in children before, but, by God, this was a special child, myopically beaming at the already remote stage, where I glimpsed something of the joint authors, a man's tuxedo and the bare shoulders of a hawk-like, black-haired, strikingly tall woman. "You've again hurt my wrist, you brute," said Lolita in a small voice as she slipped into her car seat. "I'm dreadfully sorry, my darling. My own ultraviolet darling," I said, unsuccessfully trying to catch her elbow, and I added to change the conversation, to change the direction of fate. Oh, God, oh, God. "Vivian is quite a woman. I'm sure we saw her yesterday in that restaurant in Soda Pop." "Sometimes," said Lo, "you are quite revoltingly dumb. First, Vivian is the male author. The gal author is Claire. And second, she is 40, married, and has Negro blood." "I thought," I said, kidding her, "Quilty was an ancient flame of yours, in the days when you loved me, in sweet old Ramsdale." "What?" countered Lo, her features working. "That fat dentist? You must be confusing me with some other fast little article." And I thought to myself how those fast little articles forget everything. Everything. While we, old lovers, treasure every inch of their nymphancy. With Lowe's knowledge and assent, the two post offices given to the Beardsley postmaster's forwarding addresses were P.O. Wace and P.O. Elphinstone. Next morning we visited the former and had to wait in a short but slow queue. Serene Lowe studied the rogues' gallery. Handsome Brian Bryansky, alias Anthony Bryan, alias Tony Brown. Eyes hazel, complexion fair, was wanted for kidnapping. A sad-eyed old gentleman's faux pas was male fraud, and as if that were not enough, he was cursed with deformed arches. Sullen Sullivan came with a caution, is believed armed, and should be considered extremely dangerous. If you want to make a movie out of my book, have one of these faces gently melt into my own while I look. And moreover, there was a smudgy snapshot of a missing girl, age 14, wearing brown shoes when last seen. Rhymes. Please notify Sheriff Buller. I forget my letters. As to Dolly's, there was her report and a very special-looking envelope. This I deliberately opened and perused its contents. I concluded I was doing the foreseen, since she did not seem to mind, and drifted toward the newsstand near the exit. Dolly Lo. Well, the play was a great success. All three hounds lay quiet, having been slightly drugged by Cutler, I suspect. And Linda knew all your lines. She was fine. She had alertness and control, but lacked somehow the responsiveness, the relaxed vitality, the charm of Mai, and the author's Diana. But there was no author to applaud us as last time, and the terrific electric storm outside interfered with our own modest offstage thunder. Oh, dear, life does fly. Now that everything is over, school, play, the Roy mess, mother's confinement, our baby, alas, did not live. It all seems such a long time ago, though practically I still bear traces of the paint. We are going to New York after tomorrow, and I guess I can't manage to wriggle out of accompanying my parents to Europe. I have even worse news for you, Dolly Lo. I may not be back at Beardsley if and when you return. With one thing and another, one being you know who, the other not being who you think you know, Dad wants me to go to school in Paris for 1 year while he and Fulbright are around. As expected, poor poet stumbled in scene 3 when arriving at the bit of French nonsense, remember? Ne manque pas de dire à ton amant, chimène, comme le lac est beau, car il faut qu'il t'y mène. Lucky beau, qu'il t'y. What a tongue twister. Well, be good, Lollikins. Best love from your poet, and best regards to the governor, your Mona. P.S. Because of one thing and another, my correspondence happens to be rigidly controlled, so better wait till I write to you from Europe. She never did, as far as I know. The letter contained an element of mysterious nastiness that I am too tired today to analyze. I found it later preserved in one of the tour books, and give it here a titre documentaire. I read it twice. I looked up from the letter and was about to... There was no Lo to behold. While I was engrossed in Mona's witchery, Lo had shrugged her shoulders and vanished. "Did you happen to see?" I asked of a hunchback sweeping the floor near the entrance. He had the old lecturer. He guessed she had seen a friend and had hurried out. I hurried out too. I stopped. She had not. I hurried on. I stopped again. It had happened at last. She had gone forever. In later years, I have often wondered why she did not go forever that day. Was it the retentive quality of her new summer clothes in my locked car? Was it some unripe particle in some general plan? Was it simply because, all things considered, I might as well be used to convey her to Elphinstone, the secret terminus, anyway? I only know I was quite certain she had left me forever. The non-committal mauve mountains half encircling the town seemed to me to swarm with panting, scrambling, laughing, panting Lolitas who dissolved into their haze. A big W made of white stones on the steep talus in the far vista of Cross Street seemed the very initial of woe. The new and beautiful post office I had just emerged from stood between a dormant movie house and a conspiracy of poplars. The time was 9 a.m. mountain time. The street was Main Street. I paced its blue side, peering at the opposite one. Charming it into beauty was one of those fragile young summer mornings with flashes of glass here and there and a general air of faltering and almost fainting at the prospect of an intolerably torrid noon. Crossing over, I loafed and leafed, as it were, through one long block. Drugs, real estate, fashions, auto parts, cafe, sporting goods, real estate, furniture, appliances, Western Union, cleaners, grocer, officer, officer, my daughter has run away in collusion with a detective in love with a blackmailer, took advantage of my utter helplessness. I peered into all the stores. I deliberated inly if I should talk to any of the sparse foot passengers. I did not. I sat for a while in the parked car. I inspected the public garden on the east side. I went back to fashions and auto parts. I told myself with a burst of furious sarcasm, un ricanement, that I was crazy to suspect her, that she would turn up in a minute. She did. I wheeled round and shook off the hand she had placed on my sleeve with a timid and imbecile smile. "Get into the car," I said. She obeyed, and I went on pacing up and down, struggling with nameless thoughts, trying to plan some way of tackling her duplicity. Presently she left the car and was at my side again. My sense of hearing gradually got tuned in to Station Low again, and I became aware she was telling me that she had met a former girlfriend. "Yes, whom?"
"A Beardsley girl."
"Good. I know every name of your group. Alice Adams?"
This girl was not in my group."
"Good. I have a complete student list with me. Her name, please."
"She was not in my school. She was just a town girl in Beardsley."
"Good. I have the Beardsley directory with me, too. We'll look up all the Browns."
"I only know her first name."
"Mary or Jane?"
"No, Dolly, like me."
"So that's the dead end. The mirror you break your nose against. Good. Let us try another angle. You have been absent 28 minutes. What did the two Dollies do?"
"We went to a drugstore."
"And you had there?"
"Oh, just a couple of cokes."
"Careful, Dolly. We can check that, you know."
"Well, at least she had. I had a glass of water."
"Good. Was it that place there?"
"Sure."
"Good. Come on. We'll grill the soda jerk."
"Wait a sec. Come to think of it, it might have been further down, just around the corner."
"Come on, all the same. Go in, please. Well, let's see." Opening a chained telephone book. "Dignified funeral service." No, not yet. Here we are. "Druggists, retail. Hill Drugstore, Larkin's Pharmacy, and two more. That's all Waith seems to have in the way of soda fountains, at least in the business section. Well, we will check them all." "Go to hell," she said. "Lo, rudeness will get you nowhere."
"Okay," she said. "But you're not going to trap me." "Okay, so we didn't have a pop. We just talked and looked at dresses and show windows."
"Which? That window there, for example?"
"Yeah, that one there, for example."
"Oh, Lo. Let's look closer at it." It was indeed a pretty sight. A dapper young fellow was vacuum-cleaning a carpet of sorts, upon which stood two figures that looked as if some blast had just worked havoc with them. One figure was stark naked, wigless and armless. Its comparatively small stature and smirking pose suggested that when clothed it had represented, and would represent when clothed again, a girl child of Lolita's size. But in its present state it was sexless. Next to it stood a much taller veiled bride, quite perfect and intacta, except for the lack of one arm. On the floor, at the feet of these damsels, where the man crawled about laboriously with his cleaner, there lay a cluster of three slender arms and a blonde wig. Two of the arms happened to be twisted and seemed to suggest a clasping gesture of horror and supplication.
"Look low," I said quietly. "Look well.
Is not that a rather good symbol of something or other?" "However," I went on as we got back into the car, "I have taken certain precautions. Here," delicately opening the glove compartment, "on this pad, I have our boyfriend's car number." As the ass I was, I had not memorized it. What remained of it in my mind were the initial letter and the closing figure, as if the whole amphitheatre of six signs receded concavely behind a tinted glass too opaque to allow the central series to be deciphered, but just translucent enough to make out its extreme edges. A capital P and a six. I have to go into those details, which in themselves can interest only a professional psychologue, because otherwise the reader, oh, if I could visualize him as a blonde bearded scholar with rosy lips sucking la pomme de la canne as he quaffs my manuscript, might not understand the quality of the shock I experienced upon noticing that the P had acquired the bustle of a B, and that the six had been deleted altogether. The rest, with erasures revealing the hurried shuttle smear of a pencil's rubber end, and with parts of numbers obliterated or reconstructed in a child's hand, presented a tangle of barbed wire to any logical interpretation. All I knew was the state, one adjacent to the state Beardsley was in. I said nothing. I put the pad back, closed the compartment, and drove out of Wace. Lowe had grabbed some comics from the back seat, and mobile white-bloused, one brown elbow out of the window, was deep in the current adventure of some clout or clown. 3 or 4 miles out of Wace, I turned into the shadow of a picnic ground where the morning had dumped its litter of light on an empty table. Lowe looked up with a semi-smile of surprise, and without a word I delivered a tremendous backhand cut that caught her smack in her hot, hard little cheekbone. And then the remorse. The poignant sweetness of sobbing atonement, grovelling love, the hopelessness of sensual reconciliation. In the velvet night, at Marana Motel, Marana! I kissed the yellowish soles of her long-toed feet. I immolated myself. But it was all of no avail. Both doomed were we. And soon I was to enter a new cycle of persecution. In a street of Wace, on its outskirts, oh, I'm quite sure it was not a delusion. In a street of Wace, I had glimpsed the Aztec red convertible, or its identical twin. Instead of trap, it contained 4 or 5 loud young people of several sexes. But I said nothing. After Wace, a totally new situation arose. For a day or two, I enjoyed the mental emphasis with which I told myself that we were not and never had been followed. And then I became sickeningly conscious that Trap had changed his tactics and was still with us, in this or that rented car. A veritable Proteus of the highway, with bewildering ease he switched from one vehicle to another. This technique implied the existence of garages specializing in stage automobile operations, but I never could discover the premises he used. He seemed to patronize at first the Chevrolet genus, beginning with a Campus Cream convertible, then going on to a small Horizon Blue sedan, and thenceforth fading into surf grey and driftwood grey. Then he turned to other makes, and passed through a pale dull rainbow of paint shades. And one day I found myself attempting to cope with the subtle distinction between our own dream blue Melmoth and the crest blue Oldsmobile he had rented. Greys, however, remained his favourite cryptochromism, and in agonising nightmares I tried in vain to sort out properly such ghosts as Chrysler's Shell Grey, Chevrolet's Thistle Grey, Dodge's French Grey. The necessity of being constantly on the lookout for his little moustache and open shirt, or for his baldish pate and broad shoulders, led me to a profound study of all cars on the road, behind, before, alongside, coming, going, every vehicle under the dancing sun. The quiet vacationist's automobile, with the box of tender-touch tissues on the back window. The recklessly speeding jalopy, full of pale children with a shaggy dog's head protruding, and a crumpled mudguard. The bachelor's Tudor sedan, crowded with suits on hangers. The huge fat house trailer weaving in front, immune to the Indian file of fury boiling behind it. The car with the young female passenger politely perched in the middle of the front seat to be closer to the young male driver. The car carrying on its roof a red boat bottom up. The grey car slowing up before us. The grey car catching up with us. We were in mountain country, somewhere between Snow and Champion, and rolling down an almost imperceptible grade when I had my next distinct view of Detective Paramore Trap. The grey mist behind us had deepened and concentrated into the compactness of a Dominion Blue sedan. All of a sudden, as if the car I drove responded to my poor heart's pangs, we were slithering from side to side with something making a helpless plap, plap, plap under us. "You got a flat, mister," said Cheerful Low. I pulled up, near a precipice. She folded her arms and put her foot on the dashboard. I got out and examined the right rear wheel. The base of its tire was sheepishly and hideously square. Trap had stopped some 50 yards behind us. His distant face formed a grease spot of mirth. This was my chance. I started to walk towards him with the brilliant idea of asking him for a jack, though I had one. He backed a little. I stubbed my toe against a stone, and there was a sense of general laughter. Then a tremendous truck loomed from behind Trap and thundered by me, and immediately after I heard it utter a convulsive honk. Instinctively I looked back and saw my own car gently creeping away. I could make out Low ludicrously at the wheel, and the engine was certainly running, though I remembered I had cut it but had not applied the emergency brake. And during the brief space of throb time that it took me to reach the croaking machine which came to a standstill at last, it dawned upon me that during the last 2 years, little Low had had ample time to pick up the rudiments of driving. As I wrenched the door open, I was goddamn sure she had started the car to prevent me from walking up to Trap. Her trick proved useless, however, for even while I was pursuing her, he made an energetic U-turn and was gone. I rested for a while. Low asked, wasn't I going to thank her? The car had started to move by itself. And getting no answer, she immersed herself into a study of the map. I got out again and commenced the ordeal of the orb, as Charlotte used to say. Perhaps I was losing my mind. We continued on our grotesque journey. After a forlorn and useless dip, we went up and up. On a steep grade I found myself behind the gigantic truck that had overtaken us. It was now groaning up a winding road and was impossible to pass. Out of its front part a small oblong of smooth silver, the inner wrapping of chewing gum, escaped and flew back into our windshield. It occurred to me that if I were really losing my mind, I might end by murdering somebody. In fact, said High and Dry Humbert to Floundering Humbert, it might be quite clever to prepare things, to transfer the weapon from box to pocket, so as to be ready to take advantage of the spell of insanity when it does come. By permitting Lolita to study acting, I had, fond fool, suffered her to cultivate deceit. It now appeared that it had not been merely a matter of learning the answers to such questions as what is the basic conflict in Hedda Gabler, or where are the climaxes in Love Under the Lindens, or analyse the prevailing mood of Cherry Orchard. It was really a matter of learning to betray me. How I deplored now the exercises in sensual simulation that I had so often seen her go through in our Beardsley parlour, when I would observe her from some strategic point while she, like a hypnotic subject or a performer in a mystic rite, produced sophisticated versions of infantile make-believe by going through the mimetic actions of hearing a moan in the dark, seeing for the first time a brand new young stepmother, tasting something she hated, such as buttermilk, smelling crushed grass in a lush orchard, or touching mirages of objects with her sly, slender, girl-child hands. Among my papers I still have a mimeographed sheet suggesting Tactile drill. Imagine yourself picking up and holding a ping-pong ball, an apple, a sticky date, a new flannel-fluffed tennis ball, a hot potato, an ice cube, a kitten, a puppy, a horseshoe, a feather, a flashlight. Knead with your fingers the following imaginary things. A piece of bread, india rubber, a friend's aching temple, a sample of velvet, a rose petal. You are a blind girl. Palpate the face of a Greek youth, Cyrano, Santa Claus, a baby, a laughing fawn, a sleeping stranger, your father. But she had been so pretty in the weaving of those delicate spells, in the dreamy performance of her enchantments and duties. On certain adventurous evenings in Beardsley, I also had a dance for me with the promise of some treat or gift, and although these routine leg-parted leaps of hers were more like those of a football cheerleader than like the languorous and jerky motions of a Parisian petit rat, the rhythms of her not-quite-nubile limbs had given me pleasure. But all that was nothing, absolutely nothing, to the indescribable itch of rapture that her tennis game produced in me. The teasing, delirious feeling of teetering on the very brink of unearthly order and splendour. Despite her advanced age, she was more of a nymphette than ever, with her apricot-coloured limbs, in her sub-teen tennis togs. Winged gentlemen, no hereafter is acceptable if it does not produce her as she was then, in that Colorado resort between Snow and Elphinstone, with everything right. The white, wide little boy shorts, the slender waist, the apricot midriff, the white breast kerchief whose ribbons went up and encircled her neck to end behind in a dangling knot, leaving bare her gaspingly young and adorable apricot shoulder blades with that pubescence and those lovely gentle bones, and the smooth downward tapering back. Her cap had a white peak. Her racket had cost me a small fortune. Idiot, triple idiot. I could have filmed her. I would have had her now with me, before my eyes, in the projection room of my pain and despair. She would wait and relax for a bar or two of white-lined time before going into the act of serving, and often bounced the ball once or twice, or pawed the ground a little, always at ease, always rather vague about the score, always cheerful, as she so seldom was in the dark life she led at home. Her tennis was the highest point to which I can imagine a young creature bringing the art of make-believe, although I dare say for her it was the very geometry of basic reality. The exquisite clarity of all her movements had its auditory counterpart in the pure ringing sound of her every stroke. The ball, when it entered her aura of control, became somehow whiter, its resilience somehow richer, and the instrument of precision she used upon it seemed inordinately prehensile and deliberate at the moment of clinging contact. Her form was indeed an absolutely perfect imitation of absolutely top-notch tennis, without any utilitarian results. As Edusa's sister, Electra Gold, a marvellous young coach, said to me once, while I sat on a pulsating hard bench watching Dolores Hayes toying with Linda Hall and being beaten by her, "Dolly has a magnet in the centre of her racket guts, but why the heck is she so polite?" Ah, Electra, what did it matter with such grace? I remember at the first game I watched being drenched with an almost painful convulsion of beauty assimilation. My Lolita had a way of raising her bent left knee at the ample and springy start of the service cycle, when there would develop and hang in the sun for a second a vital web of balance between toed foot, pristine armpit, burnished arm, and far back-flung racket, as she smiled up with gleaming teeth at the small globe suspended so high in the zenith of the powerful and graceful cosmos she had created for the express purpose of falling upon it with a clean, resounding crack of her golden whip. It had, that serve of hers, beauty, directness, youth, a classical purity of trajectory, and was, despite its spanking pace, fairly easy to return, having as it did no twist or sting to its long, elegant hop. That I could have had all her strokes, all her enchantments, immortalized in segments of celluloid makes me moan today with frustration. They would have been so much more than the snapshots I burned. Her overhead volley was related to her service as the envoy is to the ballade. For she had been trained, my pet, to patter up at once to the net on her nimble, vivid, white-shod feet. There was nothing to choose between her forehand and backhand drives. They were mirror images of one another. My very loins still tingle with those pistol reports repeated by crisp echoes and Electra's cries. One of the pearls of Dolly's game was the short half-volley that Ned Littam had taught her in California. She preferred acting to swimming and swimming to tennis, yet I insist that had not something within her been broken by me, not that I realized it then, she would have had on the top of her perfect game the will to win, and would have become a real girl champion. Dolores with two rackets under her arm in Wimbledon, Dolores endorsing a dromedary, Dolores turning professional, Dolores acting a girl champion in a movie, Dolores and her grey, humble, hushed husband coach, old Humbert. There was nothing wrong or deceitful in the spirit of her game, unless one considered her cheerful indifference towards its outcome as the feint of a nymphette. She, who was so cruel and crafty in everyday life, revealed an innocence, a frankness, a kindness of ball-placing that permitted a second-rate but determined player, no matter how uncouth and incompetent, to poke and cut his way to victory. Despite her small stature, she covered the 1,053 square feet of her half of the court with wonderful ease once she had entered into the rhythm of a rally, and as long as she could direct that rhythm. But any abrupt attack or sudden change of tactics on her adversary's part left her helpless. At match point, her second serve, which rather typically was even stronger and more stylish than her first, for she had none of the inhibitions that cautious winners have, would strike vibrantly the harp chord of the net and ricochet out of court. The polished gem of her drop shot was snapped up and put away by an opponent who seemed four-legged and wielded a crooked paddle. Her dramatic drives and lovely volleys would candidly fall at his feet. Over and over again, she would land an easy one into the net, and merrily mimic dismay by drooping in a ballet attitude with her forelocks hanging. So sterile were her grace and whipper that she could not even win from panting me and my old-fashioned lifting drive. I suppose I am especially susceptible to the magic of games. In my chess sessions with Gaston, I saw the board as a square pool of limpid water with rare shells and stratagems rosily visible upon the smooth, tessellated bottom, which, to my confused adversary, was all ooze and squid cloud. Similarly, the initial tennis coaching I had inflicted on Lolita, prior to the revelations that came to her through the great Californian's lessons, remained in my mind as oppressive and distressful memories, not only because she had been so hopelessly and irritatingly irritated by every suggestion of mine, but because the precious symmetry of the court, instead of reflecting the harmonies latent in her, was utterly jumbled by the clumsiness and lassitude of the resentful child I mistaught. Now things were different, and on that particular day, in the pure air of Champion Colorado, on that admirable court at the foot of steep stone stairs leading up to Champion Hotel where we had spent the night, I felt I could rest from the nightmare of unknown betrayals within the innocence of her style, of her soul, of her essential grace. She was hitting hard and flat, with her usual effortless sweep, feeding me deep skimming balls, all so rhythmically coordinated and overt as to reduce my footwork to practically a swinging stroll. Crack players will understand what I mean. My rather heavily cut serve that I had been taught by my father, who had learned it from de Kugis or Bormann, old friends of his and great champions, would have seriously troubled Milo had I really tried to trouble her. But who would upset such a lucid deer? Did I ever mention that her bare arm bore the eight of vaccination? That I loved her hopelessly? That she was only 14? An inquisitive butterfly passed, dipping between us. Two people in tennis shorts, a red-haired fellow only about 8 years my junior, with sunburnt bright pink shins, and an indolent dark girl with a moody mouth and hard eyes, about 2 years Lolita's senior, appeared from nowhere. As is common with dutiful tyros, their rackets were sheathed and framed, and they carried them not as if they were the natural and comfortable extension of certain specialized muscles, but hammers or blunderbusses or wimbles, or my own dreadful cumbersome sins. Rather unceremoniously seating themselves near my precious coat, on a bench adjacent to the court, they fell to admiring very vocally a rally of some 50 exchanges that Lowe innocently helped me to foster and uphold, until there occurred a syncope in the series, causing her to gasp as her overhead smash went out of court, whereupon she melted into winsome merriment, my golden pet. I felt thirsty by then and walked up to the drinking fountain, where Red approached me and in all humility suggested a mixed double. "I'm Bill Mead," he said, "and that's Faye Page, actress, ma fiancée," he added, pointing with his ridiculously hooded racket at polished Faye, who was already talking to Dolly. I was about to reply, "Sorry, but for I hate to have my filly involved in the chops and jabs of cheap bunglers," when a remarkably melodious cry diverted my attention. A bellboy was tripping down the steps from the hotel to our court and making me signs. I was wanted, if you please, on an urgent long-distance call, so urgent, in fact, that the line was being held for me. Certainly. I got into my coat, inside pocket heavy with pistol, and told Lo I would be back in a minute. She was picking up a ball, in the continental foot racket way, which was one of the few nice things I had taught her, and smiled. She smiled at me. An awful calm kept my heart afloat as I followed the boy up to the hotel. This, to use an American term, in which discovery, retribution, torture, death, eternity appeared in the shape of a singularly repulsive nutshell, was it. I had left her in mediocre hands, but it hardly mattered now. I would fight, of course. Oh, I would fight. Better destroy everything than surrender her. Yes, quite a climb. At the desk, a dignified Roman-nosed man, with, I suggest, a very obscure past that might reward investigation, handed me a message in his own hand. The line had not been held, after all. The note said, "Mr. Humbert, the head of Birdsley School called. Summer residence, Birdsley, 28282. Please call back immediately. Highly important." I folded myself into a booth, took a little pill, and for about 20 minutes tussled with space spooks. A quartet of propositions gradually became audible. Soprano, there was no such number in Beardsley. Alto, Miss Pratt was on her way to England. Tenor, Beardsley School had not telephoned. Bass, they could not have done so since nobody knew I was that particular day in Champion, Colorado. Upon my stinging him, the Roman took the trouble to find out if there had been a long-distance call. There had been none. A fake call from some local dial was not excluded. I thanked him. He said, "You bet." After a visit to the Purling men's room and a stiff drink at the bar, I started on my return march. From the very first terrace I saw far below on the tennis court, which seemed the size of a school child's ill-wiped slate, Golden Lolita playing in a double. She moved like a fair angel among three horrible Boschian cripples. One of these, her partner, while changing sides, jocosely slapped her on her behind with his racket. He had a remarkably round head and wore incongruous brown trousers. There was a momentary flurry. He saw me, and throwing away his racket, mine, scuttled up the slope. He waved his wrists and elbows in would-be comical imitation of rudimentary wings as he climbed, bow-legged, to the street, where his grey car awaited him. Next moment he and the greyness were gone. When I came down, the remaining trio were collecting and sorting out the balls. "Mr. Mead, who was that person?" Bill and Fay, both looking very solemn, shook their heads. That absurd obtruder had butted in to make up a double, hadn't he, Dolly? Dolly! The handle of my racket was still disgustingly warm. Before returning to the hotel, I ushered her into a little alley half-smothered in fragrant shrubs with flowers like smoke, and was about to burst into ripe sobs and plead with her imperturbed dream in the most abject manner for clarification, no matter how meretricious, of the slow awfulness enveloping me, when we found ourselves behind the convulsed Mead twosome. Assorted people, you know, meeting among idyllic settings in old comedies. Bill and Fay were both weak with laughter. We had come at the end of their private joke. It did not really matter. Speaking as if it really did not matter, and assuming apparently that life was automatically rolling on with all its routine pleasures, Lolita said she'd like to change into her bathing things and spend the rest of the afternoon at the swimming pool. It was a gorgeous day. Lolita. "Lo! Lola! Lolita!" I hear myself crying from a doorway into the sun, with the acoustics of time, domed time, endowing my call and its telltale hoarseness with such a wealth of anxiety, passion, and pain, that really it would have been instrumental in wrenching open the zipper of her nylon shroud had she been dead. Lolita. In the middle of a trim, turfed terrace, I found her at last. She had run out before I was ready. Oh, Lolita. There she was, playing with a damned dog, not me. The animal, a terrier of sorts, was losing and snapping up again and adjusting between his jaws a wet little red ball. He took rapid cords with his front paws on the resilient turf, and then would bounce away. I had only wanted to see where she was. I could not swim with my heart in that state, but who cared? And there she was, and there was I, in my robe. And so I stopped calling. But suddenly something in the pattern of her motions, as she dashed this way and that in her Aztec red bathing briefs and bra, struck me. There was an ecstasy, a madness about her frolics that was too much of a glad thing. Even the dog seemed puzzled by the extravagance of her reactions. I put a gentle hand to my chest as I surveyed the situation. The turquoise blue swimming pool some distance behind the lawn was no longer behind that lawn, but within my thorax, and my organs swam in it like excrements in the blue sea water in Nice. One of the bathers had left the pool, and half concealed by the peacocked shade of trees, stood quite still, holding the ends of the towel around his neck and following Lolita with his amber eyes. There he stood, in the camouflage of sun and shade, disfigured by them and masked by his own nakedness, his damp black hair, or what was left of it, glued to his round head, his little moustache a humid smear, the wool on his chest spread like a symmetrical trophy, his navel pulsating, his hirsute thighs dripping with bright droplets, his tight, wet black bathing trunks bloated and bursting with vigour, where his great fat bully bag was pulled up and back like a padded shield over his reversed beasthood. And as I looked at his oval, nut-brown face, it dawned upon me that what I had recognised him by was the reflection of my daughter's countenance, the same beatitude and grimace, but made hideous by his maleness. And I also knew that the child, my child, knew he was looking, enjoyed the lechery of his look, and was putting on a show of gamble and glee, the vile and beloved slut. As she made for the ball and missed it, she fell on her back, with her obscene young legs madly pedalling in the air. I could sense the musk of her excitement from where I stood, and then I saw, petrified with a kind of sacred disgust, the man close his eyes and bare his small, horribly small, and even teeth, as he leaned against a tree in which a multitude of dappled priaps shivered. Immediately afterwards, a marvellous transformation took place. He was no longer the satyr, but a very good-natured and foolish Swiss cousin, the Gustav Trapp I have mentioned more than once, who used to counteract his sprees, he drank beer with milk, the good swine, by feats of weightlifting, tottering and grunting on a lake beach with his otherwise very complete bathing suit jauntily stripped from one shoulder. This Trapp noticed me from afar, and working the towel on his nape, walked back with false insouciance to the pool. And as if the sun had gone out of the game, Low slackened and slowly got up, ignoring the ball that the terrier placed before her. Who can say what heartbreaks are caused in a dog by our discontinuing a romp? I started to say something, and then sat down on the grass with a quite monstrous pain in my chest and vomited a torrent of browns and greens that I had never remembered eating. I saw Lolita's eyes, and they seemed to be more calculating than frightened. I heard her saying to a kind lady that her father was having a fit. Then for a long time I lay in a lounge chair, swallowing pony upon pony of gin. And next morning I felt strong enough to drive on, which in later years no doctor believed. The two-room cabin we had ordered at Silver Spur Court, Elphinstone, turned out to belong to the glossily browned pine log kind that Lolita used to be so fond of in the days of our carefree first journey. Oh, how different things were now! I am not referring to Trapp or traps. After all, well, really, after all, gentlemen, it was becoming abundantly clear that all those identical detectives in prismatically changing cars were figments of my persecution mania. Recurrent images based on coincidence and chance resemblance. Soyons logique, crowed the cocky Gallic part of my brain, and proceeded to rout the notion of a Lolita-maddened salesman or comedy gangster with stooges persecuting me and hoaxing me and otherwise taking riotous advantage of my strained relations with the law. I remember humming my panic away. I remember evolving even an explanation of the Birdsley telephone call. But if I could dismiss Trapp, as I had dismissed my convulsions on the lawn at Champion, I could do nothing with the anguish of knowing Lolita to be so tantalizingly, so miserably unattainable and beloved, on the very eve of a new era, when my alembics told me she should stop being a nymphette, stop torturing me. An additional, abominable and perfectly gratuitous worry was lovingly prepared for me in Elphinstone. Lowe had been dull and silent during the last lap, 200 mountainous miles uncontaminated by smoke-grey sleuths or zigzagging zanies. She hardly glanced at the famous, oddly shaped, splendidly flushed rock which jutted above the mountains and had been the take-off for Nirvana on the part of a temperamental showgirl. The town was newly built or rebuilt on the flat floor of a 7,000-foot-high valley. It would soon bore, though, I hoped, and we would spin on to California, to the Mexican border, to mythical bays, saguaro deserts, Fata Morganas. José Lizarrabengoa, as you remember, planned to take his Carmen to the Etayuni. I conjured up a Central American tennis competition in which Dolores Hayes and various Californian schoolgirl champions would dazzlingly participate. Goodwill tours on that smiling level eliminate the distinction between passport and sport. Why did I hope we would be happy abroad? A change of environment is the traditional fallacy upon which doomed loves and lungs rely. Mrs. Hayes, the brisk, brickly-rouged, blue-eyed widow who ran the motor court, asked me if I was Swiss, perchance, because her sister had married a Swiss ski instructor. I was, whereas my daughter happened to be half-Irish. I registered, Hayes gave me the key and a twinkling smile, and, still twinkling, showed me where to park the car. Lowe crawled out and shivered a little. The luminous evening air was decidedly crisp. Upon entering the cabin, she sat down on a chair at a card table, buried her face in the crook of her arm, and said she felt awful. Shamming, I thought. Shamming, no doubt, to evade my caresses. I was passionately parched. But she began to whimper in an unusually dreary way when I attempted to fondle her. Lolita ill? Lolita dying? Her skin was scalding hot. I took her temperature orally, then looked up a scribbled formula I fortunately had in a jotter, and after laboriously reducing the meaningless to me degrees Fahrenheit to the intimate centigrade of my childhood, found she had a 40.4, which at least made sense. Hysterical little nymphs might, I knew, run up all kinds of temperature, even exceeding a fatal count. And I would have given her a sip of hot spiced wine and two aspirins and kissed the fever away, if, upon an examination of her lovely uvula, one of the gems of her body, I had not seen that it was burning red. I undressed her. Her breath was bittersweet. Her brown rose tasted of blood. She was shaking from head to toe. She complained of a painful stiffness in the upper vertebrae, and I thought of poliomyelitis as any American parent would. Giving up all hope of intercourse, I wrapped her up in a lap-robe and carried her into the car. Kind Mrs. Hayes, in the meantime, had alerted the local doctor. "You're lucky it happened here," she said, for not only was Blue the best man in the district, but the Elphinstone Hospital was as modern could be, despite its limited capacity. With a heterosexual El Koenig in pursuit, thither I drove, half blinded by a royal sunset on the lowland site, and guided by a little old woman, a portable witch, perhaps his daughter, whom Mrs. Hayes had lent me, and whom I was never to see again. Dr. Blue, whose learning, no doubt, was infinitely inferior to his reputation, assured me it was a virus infection, and when I alluded to her comparatively recent flu, curtly said that this was another bug. He had had 40 such cases on his hands, all of which sounded like the ague of the ancients. I wondered if I should mention with a casual chuckle that my 15-year-old daughter had had a minor accident while climbing an awkward fence with her boyfriend. But knowing I was drunk, I decided to withhold the information till later, if necessary. To an unsmiling blonde bitch of a secretary, I gave my daughter's age as practically 16. While I was not looking, my child was taken away from me. In vain I insisted I be allowed to spend the night on a welcome mat in the corner of their damned hospital. I ran up constructivistic flights of stairs. I tried to trace my darling so as to tell her she had better not babble, especially if she felt as light-headed as we all did. At one point, I was rather dreadfully rude to a very young and very cheeky nurse with overdeveloped gluteal parts and blazing black eyes, of Basque descent, as I learned. Her father was an imported shepherd, a trainer of sheepdogs. Finally, I returned to the car and remained in it for I do not know how many hours, hunched up in the dark, stunned by my new solitude, looking out open-mouthed, now at the dimly illuminated, very square and low hospital building squatting in the middle of its lawny block, now up at the wash of stars and the jagged silvery ramparts of the Haute Montagne, where at the moment Mary's father, lonely Joseph Law, was dreaming of Oleron, Lagor, Rolas, Cursege, or seducing a ewe. Such like fragrant vagabond thoughts have been always a solace to me in times of unusual stress, and only when, despite liberal libations, I felt fairly numbed by the endless night, did I think of driving back to the motel. The old woman had disappeared, and I was not quite sure of my way. Wide gravel roads crisscrossed drowsy rectangular shadows. I made out what looked like the silhouette of gallows on what was probably a school playground. And in another waste-like block, there rose in domed silence the pale temple of some local sect. I found the highway at last, and then the motel, where millions of so-called millers, a kind of insect, were swarming around the neon contours of no vacancy. And when, at 3 a.m., after one of those untimely hot showers which, like some mordant, only helped to fix a man's despair and weariness, I lay on her bed that smelled of chestnuts and roses and peppermint, and the very delicate, very special French perfume I latterly allowed her to use, I found myself unable to assimilate the simple fact that for the first time in 2 years I was separated from my Lolita. All at once it occurred to me that her illness was somehow the development of a theme, that it had the same taste and tone as the series of linked impressions which had puzzled and tormented me during our journey. I imagined that secret agent, or secret lover, or prankster, or hallucination, or whatever he was, prowling around the hospital. And Aurora had hardly warmed her hands, as the pickers of lavender say in the country of my birth, when I found myself trying to get into that dungeon again, knocking upon its green doors, breakfastless, stoolless, in despair. This was Tuesday. And Wednesday or Thursday, splendidly reacting like the darling she was to some serum, sparrow's sperm or dugong's dung, she was much better, and the doctor said that in a couple of days she would be skipping again. Of the 8 times I visited her, the last one alone remained sharply engraved on my mind. It had been a great feat to come, for I felt all hollowed out by the infection that by then was at work on me too. None will know the strain it was to carry that bouquet, that load of love, those books that I had travelled 60 miles to buy, Browning's dramatic works, The History of Dancing, Clowns and Columbines, The Russian Ballet, Flowers of the Rockies, The Theatre Guild Anthology, Tennis by Helen Wills, who had won the National Junior Girl Singles at the age of 15. As I was staggering up to the door of my daughter's $13-a-day private room, Mary Law, the beastly young part-time nurse who had taken an unconcealed dislike to me, emerged with a finished breakfast tray, placed it with a quick crash on the chair in the corridor, and fundament jigging, shot back into the room, probably to warn her poor little Dolores that the tyrannical father was creeping up on crepe soles with books and a bouquet. The latter I had composed of wild flowers and beautiful leaves gathered with my own gloved hands on a mountain pass at sunrise. I hardly slept at all that fateful week. Feeding my common seater well, idly I glanced at the tray. On a yolk-stained plate there was a crumpled envelope. It had contained something, since one edge was torn, but there was no address on it, nothing at all, save a phony armorial design with Ponderosa Lodge in green letters. Thereupon I performed a chasse-croisé with Mary, who was in the act of bustling out again. Wonderful how fast they move and how little they do, these rumpy young nurses. She glowered at the envelope I had put back, uncrumpled. "You better not touch," she said, nodding directionally. "Could burn your fingers." Below my dignity to rejoin, all I said was, "Je croyais que c'était un bill, not un billet doux." Then, entering the sunny room to Lolita, "Bonjour, mon petit." "The law is," said Mary Law, entering with me, past me, through me, the plump whore, and blinking, and starting to fold very rapidly a white flannel blanket as she blinked. "The law is, your pappy thinks you are getting letters from my boyfriend." "It's me," smugly tapping herself on the small gilt cross she wore, "gets them. And my pappy can parley-voo as well as yours." She left the room. Dolores, so rosy and russet, lips freshly painted, hair brilliantly brushed, bare arms straightened out on neat coverlet, lay innocently beaming at me or nothing. On the bed-table, next to a paper napkin and a pencil, her topaz ring burned in the sun. "What gruesome funeral flowers," she said. "Thanks all the same, but do you mind very much cutting out the French? It annoys everybody." Back at the usual rush came the ripe young hussy, reeking of urine and garlic, with the desolate news, which her fair patient eagerly accepted, ignoring the sumptuously illustrated volumes I had brought. "My sister Anne," said Mary, topping information with afterthought, "works at the Ponderosa place." Poor Bluebeard. Those brutal brothers. "Est-ce que tu ne m'aimes plus, ma Carmen?" She never had. At the moment, I knew my love was as hopeless as ever. And I also knew the two girls were conspirators, plotting in Basque or Zemphirian against my hopeless love. I shall go further and say that Lo was playing a double game, since she was also fooling sentimental Mary, whom she had told, I suppose, that she wanted to dwell with her fun-loving young uncle, and not with cruel, melancholy me. And another nurse, whom I never identified, and the village idiot who carted cots and coffins into the elevator, and the idiotic green lovebirds in a cage in the waiting room, all were in the plot, the sordid plot. I suppose Mary thought comedy father Professor Humbletoldy was interfering with the romance between Dolores and her father substitute, Roly-Poly Romeo. For you were rather larder, you know, Rom, despite all that snow and joy juice. My throat hurt. I stood swallowing at the window and stared at the mountains, at the romantic rock high up in the smiling, plotting sky. "My Carmen," I said. I used to call her that sometimes. "We shall leave this raw, sore town as soon as you get out of bed." "Incidentally, I want all my clothes," said the Gitinilla, humping up her knees and turning to another page. "Because really," I continued, "there is no point in staying here."
"There's no point in staying anywhere," said Lolita.
I lowered myself into a cretonne chair, and opening the attractive botanical work, attempted, in the fever-humming hush of the room, to identify my flowers. This proved impossible. Presently a musical bell softly sounded somewhere in the passage. I do not think they had more than a dozen patients. Three or four were lunatics, as Lowe had cheerfully informed me earlier, in that show-place of a hospital, and the staff had too much leisure. However, likewise for reasons of show, regulations were rigid. It is also true that I kept coming at the wrong hours. Not without a secret flow of dreamy malice, visionary Mary, next time it will be une belle dame tout en bleu floating through Roaring Gulch, plucked me by the sleeve to lead me out. I looked at her hand. It dropped. I was leaving voluntarily. Dolores Hayes reminded me to bring her next morning. She did not remember where the various things she wanted were. "Bring me," she cried, out of sight already, door on the move, closing. Closed. The new grey suitcase and mother's trunk. But by the next morning I was shivering and boozing and dying in the motel bed she had used for just a few minutes, and the best I could do under the circular and dilating circumstances was to send the two bags over with the widow's beau, a robust and kindly trucker. I imagined Lo displaying her treasures to Mary. No doubt I was a little delirious, and on the following day I was still vibration rather than solid. For when I looked out of the bathroom window at the adjacent lawn, I saw Dolly's beautiful young bicycle propped up there on its support, the graceful front wheel looking away from me as it always did, and a sparrow perched on the saddle. But it was the landlady's bike, and smiling a little and shaking my poor head over my fond fancies, I tottered back to my bed and lay as quiet as a saint. Saint, forsooth, while brown Dolores, on a patch of sunny green, with Sanchicha reading stories in a movie magazine, which was represented by numerous specimens wherever Dolores landed. And there was some great national celebration in town, judging by the firecrackers, veritable bombs that exploded all the time, and at 5 minutes to 2 p.m. I heard the sound of whistling lips nearing the half-open door of my cabin, and then a thump upon it. It was Big Frank. He remained framed in the open door, one hand on its jamb, leaning forward a little. Howdy. Nurse Law was on the telephone. She wanted to know, was I better and would I come today? At 20 paces, Frank used to look a mountain of health. At 5, as now, he was a ruddy mosaic of scars. Had been blown through a wall overseas. But despite nameless injuries, he was able to man a tremendous truck, fish, hunt, drink, and buoyantly dally with roadside ladies. That day, either because it was such a great holiday or simply because he wanted to divert a sick man, he had taken off the glove he usually wore on his left hand, the one pressing against the side of the door, and revealed to the fascinated sufferer not only an entire lack of fourth and fifth fingers, but also a naked girl with cinnabar nipples and indigo delta, charmingly tattooed on the back of his crippled hand, its index and middle digit making her legs, while his wrist bore her flower-crowned head. Oh, delicious, reclining against the woodwork like some sly fairy. I asked him to tell Mary Law I would stay in bed all day and would get in touch with my daughter sometime tomorrow, if I felt probably Polynesian. He noticed the direction of my gaze and made her right hip twitch amorously. Okie dokie, Big Frank sang out, slapped the jam, and whistling, carried my message away, and I went on drinking. And by morning the fever was gone. And although I was as limp as a toad, I put on the purple dressing gown over my maize yellow pyjamas and walked over to the office telephone. Everything was fine? A bright voice informed me that yes, everything was fine. My daughter had checked out the day before, around 2. Her uncle, Mr. Gustav, had called for her with a cocker spaniel pup and a smile for everyone and a black Cadillac, and had paid Dolly's bill in cash and told them to tell me I should not worry and keep warm. They were at Grandpa's ranch, as agreed. Elphinstone was, and I hope still is, a very cute little town. It was spread like a maquette, you know, with its neat green-wooled trees and red-roofed houses over the valley floor, and I think I have alluded earlier to its model school and temple and spacious rectangular block, some of which were, curiously enough, just unconventional pastures with a mule or a unicorn grazing in the young July morning mist. Very amusing. At one gravel-groaning sharp turn I sideswiped a parked car, but said to myself telestically and telepathically, I hoped, to its gesticulating owner, that I would return later. Address bird school, bird, new bird. The gin kept my heart alive, but maze my brain. And after some lapses and losses common to dream sequences, I found myself in the reception room, trying to beat up the doctor, and roaring at people under chairs, and clamouring for Mary, who luckily for her was not there. Rough hands plucked at my dressing gown, ripping off a pocket, and somehow I seemed to have been sitting on a bald, brown-headed patient, whom I had mistaken for Dr. Blue, and who eventually stood up, remarking with a preposterous accent, "Now who is neurotic, I ask?" And then a gaunt, unsmiling nurse presented me with 7 beautiful, beautiful books and the exquisitely folded tartan laprobe and demanded a receipt. And in the sudden silence I became aware of a policeman in the hallway, to whom my fellow motorist was pointing me out, and I meekly signed the very symbolic receipt, thus surrendering my Lolita to all those apes. But what else could I do? One simple and stark thought stood out, and this was, freedom for the moment is everything. One false move, and I might have been made to explain a life of crime. So I simulated a coming out of a daze. To my fellow motorist, I paid what he thought was fair. To Dr. Blue, who by then was stroking my hand, I spoke in tears of the liquor I bolstered too freely a tricky but not necessarily diseased heart with. To the hospital in general I apologised with a flourish that almost bowled me over, adding, however, that I was not on particularly good terms with the rest of the Humbert clan. To myself I whispered that I still had my gun and was still a free man, free to trace the fugitive, free to destroy my brother.